Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting the U.S. tries its hand at reducing violence in Israel. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met Thursday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on the surge of violence in Israel. They met in Germany. Netanyahu made his case on his assessment of who is to blame.
There's no question that this wave of attacks is driven directly by incitement from Hamas, incitement from the Islamist movement in Israel, and incitement, I'm sorry to say, from President Abbas, the Palestinian Authority.
Following the meeting, the U.S. Secretary of State expressed some optimism.
If parties want to try, and I believe they do, want to move to a de-escalation, I think there are a set of choices that are available.
The talks got underway in Berlin as the violence continued in Israel. Israeli police shot two Palestinians allegedly involved in the stabbing attack of a Jewish man. Thursday's attack is the latest incident in the ongoing violence that has killed at least 50 Palestinians and 8 Israelis. Kerry plans to talk with Palestinian President Abbas at the end of the week. A consulting and analysis firm says attacks by the Islamic State group have jumped by more than 40% per day in the third quarter compared to the previous 3 months. The study released Thursday by IHS Jane's Terrorism and Insurgency Center says that from July through the end of September of 2015, the Islamic State group claimed a total of 1,086 attacks worldwide, a 42% increase in the average daily number. This is VOA News. Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is now answering questions before the Republican-led Special House Committee investigating the deadly 2012 attacks on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone filed this report.
Republicans are expected to grill former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about the terror attacks that took 4 American lives, including U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Chris Stevens. But Clinton has seized on Republican comments. The Benghazi committee is targeting her politically.
Everybody thought Hillary Clinton was unbeatable, right? But we put together a Benghazi special committee. What are her numbers today?
Clinton went on the attack during the recent Democratic presidential debate.
This committee is basically an arm of the Republican National Committee.
Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
A masked man wielding knife-like weapons walked from classroom to classroom to stab students as they opened the door, killing a teacher and a boy and wounding 2 others at a school in western Sweden before being shot dead by police. Local media showed what it said was a picture of the assailant carrying a sword and dressed in a black trench coat and helmet, posing for pictures with students before the attack. A Halloween, one witness student told a local television station, "We thought it was a joke, a Halloween prank or something, but it wasn't." The suspect in his early 20s died later of his injuries at a hospital. He had no criminal record, and the motive for the attack was not known. A U.S. defense official says one American serviceman was killed when U.S. forces took part in a rescue operation to free scores of Kurds held hostage in northern Iraq by Islamic State militants. Iraqi officials, quoted by the New York Times, said the operation involved American helicopters, Kurdish and American Special Operations Forces, and airstrikes. Separate accounts from the Pentagon say 70 Kurdish hostages were freed during the mission near a city west of Kirkuk. 6 people are under arrest in Mexico for allegedly planning the prison escape of drug trafficker Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. Mexico's attorney general says Guzman's brother-in-law is among those suspected of planning and carrying out his July escape through a tunnel underneath his jail cell. Authorities have intensified their search for Guzman in remote areas of Mexico in recent days, but so far he remains free. Nearly 24 prison officials and staffers have been arrested in connection with Guzman's escape. The president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, has been awarded China's alternative to the Nobel Peace Prize for what the prize committee called his inspired national leadership and service to Pan-Africanism. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
The situation continues to deteriorate. If we look at what it was like at the beginning of the conflict and where we're at, it has worsened, and we have not seen pockets of potential famine in a long time.
That's UNICEF's Vilma Tyler, who says food insecurity in South Sudan is reaching catastrophic levels. We'll have details coming up. Also, Boko Haram fighters killed 20 civilians as the insurgents fled an offensive by Nigeria military this morning in Borno State. And the UN human rights chief criticizes the Czech Republic for involuntary detention of migrants and refugees for more than 90 days. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Guinea, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, three UN agencies warn that nearly 4 million people in South Sudan face severe food insecurity and at least 30,000 face starvation. The agencies say the two-year-old conflict has pushed people to the brink of catastrophe. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Food Program, Food and Agriculture Organization, and UNICEF base their warning on what's called an IPC analysis. It's conducted several times a year in South Sudan to determine the state of food insecurity. This is the first time the analysis has found any of the population in Phase 5 on the 5-point scale. Phase 5 is known as the catastrophic level. Vilma Tyler is UNICEF's chief of nutrition in South Sudan.
The situation continues to deteriorate. If we look at what it was like at the beginning of the conflict and where we're at, it has worsened, and we have not seen pockets of potential famine in a long time.
She says humanitarian agencies are not able to reach many people in need. The worst area is Southern Unity State.
We have not had access to it for a long time because of the fighting. Even though UNICEF and other partners have sent at different times what we call rapid response missions, short-term missions, when there were some windows of relative calm, we've sent them to these areas to deliver services. But again, it's very short-term, a week to 10 days. But we have not had permanent presence to support the communities over there.
Tyler says the South Sudan government does not provide protection for humanitarian workers, and the agencies themselves are not able to do that either.
Our partners, of course, don't have the capacity to say we're going to stay at all costs because there's a huge risk for the staff as well. And additionally, even if we stay to deliver or the partners stay to deliver, looting for supplies or robberies also makes it very difficult to operate under these conditions.
The latest food security analysis finds many children under five in an emergency situation due to acute malnutrition. Most are in Jonglei, Upper Nile, and Unity States. The UN agencies say this is due to inadequate food consumption, poor maternal and child feeding practices, and limited delivery of health and nutrition services.
Because these families have been displaced, children are exposed to very tough conditions where they have no shelter, they don't have access to clean water, they're not eating enough, so their immune system is compromised. As such, they're more easily affected by malaria. And being fragile to begin with, then they deteriorate very quickly, so they become severely malnourished in a very short period of time.
This normally would be harvesting season in South Sudan, when food security should improve. But the UN agencies say many displaced families are eating one meal a day, consisting of fish and water lilies. UNICEF, the WFP, and FAO are calling on the warring parties to grant immediate access to areas where millions are at risk. A peace deal, including a ceasefire, was signed in August. Nevertheless, conditions have grown worse. World Food Program Country Director Joyce Luma says the people of South Sudan need peace, nutritious food, and other humanitarian assistance to survive and rebuild their lives. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Ten minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The UN Human Rights Chief has criticized the Czech Republic for involuntary detention of migrants and refugees for more than 90 days. Zaid Ra'ad al-Hussein says the actions may constitute a systematic violation of human rights. He cited the Czech government's own internal reports. They indicated about 200 children were found in one detention facility north of Prague and that officials confiscated money from migrants during strip searches. The International Organization for Migration says more than 670,000 people have arrived by sea this year, fleeing war zones and poverty in the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. Sweden expects to receive about 190,000 migrants this year, but will be putting some of them in tents for winter. Austria suspended rail traffic near its border with Slovenia to reduce risk of accidents. More than 3,000 migrants crossed the tracks and walked away from a migrant collection point. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban urged European leaders to change their immigration policies and consult voters. Mr. Orban says the flow of migrants in Europe threatens the democratic order. Since Hungary closed its borders last week, migrants have created an alternative route through Croatia to Slovenia. Since Saturday, Slovenia has struggled to control more than 34,000 migrants. 12,000 entered Slovenia yesterday. And in Nigeria, Boko Haram fighters killed 20 civilians as the insurgents fled an offensive by the military this morning in Borno State. Local self-defense forces say the gunmen killed passengers in four passing cars and looted and burned all of the homes in nearby Jingalta village. The gunmen fled in pickup trucks on motorcycles. In neighboring Niger, two soldiers were killed and several injured yesterday in a foiled suicide attack by suspected Boko Haram fighters. Niger's defense minister says the U.S. has given his government two Cessna C-208 intelligence and reconnaissance planes and 30 military vehicles and ambulances to fight terrorism on two fronts. Niger is under threat from jihadist fighters on their northern borders with Mali and Libya and from Boko Haram extremists along its southeast border with Nigeria. The police chief in Lagos, Nigeria, says Boko Haram bombs are getting smaller and are being placed in iPads and cell phones. Inspector General Solomon Arace says explosive devices may now be planted in small electronic devices and left for innocent civilians to pick up. Human rights groups in Cameroon say prisons constructed for 500 detainees are housing more than 3,000 people, many of whom can be held for years without charge in inhumane conditions. The government says it is working on solutions. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Yaoundé prison.
Aristus Beba has been locked up at the Kondenge Central Prison for 5 years. The 26-year-old says he has never stood trial.
My elder brother accused me of stealing money from the house and I was taken here. I've been beaten up several times here. I had to clean the toilet every time. Any small food they bring for me here, they take everything. I don't have anything. I'm really suffering here.
Kondenge Prison was constructed for 750 inmates, but now holds more than 4,000 men, women and children. Angelina Dufay has been detained here since 2013 with her then 2-week-old baby. She was sentenced to 3 years for aggravated theft. Cameroon National Institute of Statistics reports there are about 30,000 people held in the country's 78 prisons. The law requires police to transfer a detainee to prison 24 hours after an arrest. Chairman of Cameroon's National Commission on Human Rights and Freedoms, Chemuta Divine.
Not all the persons in prisons are criminals. There are too many people that will just find themselves in through the system that is in place. You see young people who should be out helping in production and improving upon the economy. They are there in their great numbers. They are tortured. Prisons should not be torture centers. We have said this clear and clear.
Cameroon's Secretary of State in charge of Penitentiary Administration, Do Jerome, says reforms are planned.
We have the vision of reintroducing what used to be known as production prisons, so that by the time the inmates come out of prison, out of detention, they have known certain traits which will help them to be rehabilitated in the society.
In September, Amnesty International said in the Marwa prison near Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, half of the 1,300 prisoners were Boko Haram suspects. Amnesty said prisoners are housed without proper hygiene or health care, and some are even held in chains. Rights groups working on Cameroon's eastern border with the Central African Republic say refugees who have left camps because of difficult living conditions are being arrested and locked up. The government denies accusations from rights groups that refugees from the CAR and Boko Haram suspects are swelling prison populations. But Cameroon's government spokesperson, Issa Chiruma, says they are aware of congestion and inhumane treatment.
This is a problem that we know very well. And you said you are perfectly right. Justice delay is justice denied. The government is committed, is engaged to speed up the trial of all of those, not only Boko Haram. We have our brothers, our sisters who are in jail for giving time, and unfortunately who are not tried for many reasons, understandable and justifiable reason.
Chiruma says financial constraints are holding up construction of more prisons. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Three UN agencies warned that nearly 4 million people in South Sudan face severe food insecurity and at least 30,000 face starvation. And Boko Haram fighters killed 20 civilians as the insurgents fled an offensive by Nigeria military this morning in Borno State. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. This Sunday's elections in Tanzania pit the long-ruling Chamba Chamba Mapinduzi Party against the opposition Civic United Front. The latest Ipsos Synovate poll shows ruling party candidate John Magufuli leading with 62% of the vote. VOA's Vincent McCorry is in Tanzania following the polls. He told reporter William Eagle the opposition disagrees with the polling.
I think the opposition is basing their observations on perhaps the numbers that have been turning up for the opposition candidate rallies. If you look at the people that are turning up for Mr. Lowassa's rallies, the massive, massive crowd. And on the basis of that, a majority of those in the opposition believe that there's no question that he definitely is going to win this election. But, you know, when you go to a scientific poll, again, it all depends on where the polling is done. If you look at how the support is divided here. A majority of those who are in the more urban areas are supportive of the opposition. A majority of those who are in the more of the rural side or way out of town, you find that a majority are really supporters of the ruling party. So again, those who do scientific polls, they know how they sample the people they're interviewing. But people are looking at how the turnout is, especially at the political rallies for these candidates. And I think that is, for them, what tells them how this election might turn out to be.
Over 50% of the population is said to be young people. Do we have any clear idea who they favor? After all, even the ruling party candidate is in his early 50s. Do they have a favorite?
Yeah, the young people are extremely enthusiastic about this election. They are upbeat and they feel that it's time for change. They're more driven not by the age of the presidential candidate of the opposition, but by the fact that there's a possibility that the opposition is going to take this seat this time. And while they may be voting for an older person, they feel that by voting for the opposition, they'll be voting for an alternative to the ruling party, and that is change for them.
Vincent, the Southern African Development Community is encouraging voters to leave the voting areas and go home after voting to prevent violence and other problems. But I understand the opposition has quite a different view.
Yeah, this has become a very controversial issue here. The opposition holds that the Constitution provides for people to stay within 200 meters or at least further away, but can hang around the polling stations for as long as they want until the results are announced. The ruling party, or at least the government, as you can say at this moment, says that people need to go away as soon as they cast their votes. And why? This is what an official of the ruling party told me. They think that if people are allowed to stay around the polling stations, the opposition might use their youth to prevent supporters of the ruling party from coming to cast their votes, and particularly, you know, women and older people. The opposition is saying, no, you're not going anywhere, because we do strongly believe that the ruling party is scheming to rig this election. And so we want to be around there just to make sure we witness what's happening. And if there's something that is unacceptable, we want to raise alarm.
Vincent, it sounds like a lot of people are worried about who's counting the vote and how it's counted. Are all political parties confident that there are enough measures put in place to ensure that this vote will be clean?
Ideally, the Electoral Commission is expected to be fairly independent. And also there are observer teams here that ideally are supposed to be looking at how the process goes down. But be sure the opposition strongly believes that the CCM party has a lot of influence over how the election, the votes are going to be counted. But I spoke to an official of the CCM party, the ruling party, Mr. Januari Makamba, who is the Deputy Minister of Communication Science and Technology. And asked him that question: is your presidential candidate crafting like a concession speech? He said no, because we have no plans to lose.
That was VOA reporter Vincent McCoury in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. Opposition and civil society groups in the Republic of Congo are to meet today with envoys from the United States and Europe to discuss the country's political crisis. Four demonstrators were killed by police Tuesday during protest against a possible third term for President Denis Sassou Nguesso. Mr. Nguesso, who's 70, wants to run for another seven-year term in next year's election, but he cannot run unless voters approve a change in the Constitution on Sunday. It now permits only two terms in office and places an age limit of 70 on presidential candidates. The World Health Organization says millions of premature deaths can be prevented each year by reducing short-lived climate pollutants. A WHO report recommends cutting emissions of black carbon, ozone, and methane. Lisa Schlein reports from headquarters in Geneva.
Carbon dioxide is the main greenhouse gas that causes global warming. But black carbon or soot and methane and ozone in urban smog all contribute to climate change and are harmful to health. The World Health Organization says emissions from short-lived climate pollutants cause cardiovascular and respiratory diseases, including heart disease, pulmonary disease, respiratory infections, and lung cancer. It says they are responsible for many of the more than 7 million premature deaths each year linked to air pollution. The WHO says the pollutants also can decrease agricultural yields. WHO Environment Chief Maria Nera says the pollutants, which exist both outdoors and indoors, have a strong impact on climate change. But the good news, she says, is they only remain in the atmosphere for a few days to 10 years, compared to carbon dioxide, which can persist for hundreds, even thousands of years.
The fact that they are short-lived pollutants, when you address them, you can reduce emissions very rapidly and then improve both air quality as well as slowing the rate of the near-term climate change. You will have an immediate reduction in the ill health and diseases caused by the reduction of air pollution.
The WHO has come up with a number of available, affordable measures to mitigate short-lived climate pollutants. Topping the list is reducing vehicle emissions by implementing higher emissions and efficiency standards. Indoor air pollution is another source of ill health and premature death. The WHO reports about 2.8 billion low-income households rely on dirty fuels such as coal, wood, and kerosene for cooking and heating. It says cleaner and more efficient stove and fuel alternatives could reduce the health risks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Reuters news agency says the European Union is inviting President Pierre Nkurunziza to meet over Burundi's political crisis or face termination of major foreign aid. EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini is opening a consultation process with Burundi to seek an end to a political conflict that has left more than 100 dead since April and displaced 70,000. And EU officials say the consultation is a last resort for Burundi's leadership. Burundi risks losing $56 million in Belgian foreign aid. The EU already has frozen assets and banned travel of four of Mr. Nkurunziza's supporters. The crisis centers on Mr. Nkurunziza's controversial re-election last summer to a third term in office. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share the ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. Right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Three UN agencies warn that nearly 4 million people in South Sudan face severe food insecurity and at least 30,000 face starvation. And Boko Haram fighters killed 20 civilians as the insurgents fled an offensive by Nigeria military this morning in Borno State. Coming up, we'll have music from Guinea and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand Rugby World Cup tops your sports report today.
Kim, let's kick off with the Rugby World Cup in England. The Springboks of South Africa will face the defending champion All Blacks of New Zealand Saturday in a mouth-watering semi-final in London. The game at Twickenham Stadium features two world rugby powers who each have lifted the trophy twice, South Africa in 1995 and 2007, and New Zealand in 1987 and 2011. Springboks head coach Heineke Meyer says it's always a thrill to play the All Blacks.
I live for these games, you know, standing there, and I always stand at the bottom facing the Arca just out of respect. I never go up to the box. I'd wait till after the Arca because it's just great. That's, sometimes I don't know why you do this job, and then you stand there and you feel the adrenaline pumping, and you face the Arca, and you're just so blessed to be there. So I love playing the All Blacks. You know, I love what they stand for. I love what South Africa stands for, and it doesn't get bigger than this.
Players on the Springboks and the All Blacks are also looking forward to this big semi-final on Saturday. Conrad Smith plays center for the All Blacks of New Zealand. He says he expects another hard-fought match against South Africa.
With South Africa, there is that consistent level physicality, but also performance in terms of we never seem to catch the other team on an off night, which sometimes happens with other teams, and you sort of get bigger margins. But certainly in the last 5 or 6 years, it's been tight, and even the games, you know, obviously there's eventual winners, and even if the score has been, I'm struggling to think of any that have been above sort of 7 or 8 points, but, you know, they've certainly, it's sort of come down to 2 or 3 turning points in a game and it could have either, you know, easily gone the other way. So they're always tight matchups, and I'm sure this one will be just the same.
New Zealand rugby player Conrad Smith, who's expecting another tight match on Saturday against the Springboks of South Africa at Twickenham Stadium in London. Argentina goes against Australia Sunday in the second semifinal, also at Twickenham. The winners of the two semifinals will meet in the Rugby World Cup final on October 31st at Twickenham.
Hi, I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. Turning to African football, second round action kicks off next month in the continent's qualifying campaign for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. Remember, VOA World Cup fans, ultimately five African teams will book tickets to Russia. Our African football guru, David Legg, takes a look at the upcoming matches.
It's home and away matches. The winners go through to the group stage, and the bad news is that the losers go out of the competition. They will be out of the race for Russia. Niger will play Cameroon. Mauritania, one of the most improved sides in Africa, they will be up against Tunisia. Namibia face Guinea-Conakry. Ethiopia face Congo-Brazzaville. It's Chad against Egypt, Comores against Ghana, Swaziland against Nigeria, Botswana against Mali, Burundi against the Democratic Republic of Congo, Liberia up against Ivory Coast, Madagascar against Senegal, Kenya against Cape Verde, Tanzania against Algeria, Sudan against Zambia, Libya against Rwanda, Morocco against Equatorial Guinea, Mozambique against Gabon, Benin against Burkina Faso, Togo against Uganda, and Angola against South Africa. Let's look at some of those matches. And one that caught my eye is Morocco against Equatorial Guinea, because this match brings together the team that should have hosted the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, that's Morocco, but they then withdrew because of fears about the Ebola epidemic. And their place was taken by Equatorial Guinea. They took over as hosts, and they did very well indeed, reaching the semifinals. So that's going to be an interesting tie-up. Another one is Angola against South Africa. Now, South Africa have got the whip hand over the Angolans in the sense that they've won six of the previous nine meetings and drawn the other three. But those matches, most of them have been very tight affairs indeed. And the South Africans, I think, looking a little bit nervously ahead to this match. Bafana have just returned from Central America, where they had what were conceived to be good results. They beat Costa Rica 1-0 in San Jose, and then they drew 1-1 away with Honduras. But the problem with the Bafana is they are very inconsistent. At times against Costa Rica, they looked like the best side in Africa, and at times against Honduras, they looked like what they are in effect. And that is the 17th ranked country in Africa. You would fancy the South Africans to get through, but it could be close. Another intriguing tie, Sonny, between Togo and Uganda. Now, when those sides met in the last Africa Cup of Nations qualifying competition, the Togolese won 1-0 in Kampala and also won in Lomé. So revenge there on the menu for the Ugandans, who I feel will be the slight favorites. Benin against Burkina Faso, another one that could go either way. The Burkinabe not doing particularly well these days, having reached in 2013 the Cup of Nations finals. Swaziland, after scoring eight goals against Djibouti, they're going to find life a lot tougher against a Nigerian side that recently beat Cameroon 3-0 in a friendly. And another interesting tie is surely that between Liberia and the Ivory Coast. Liberia did not impress at home in the previous round against Guinea-Bissau and were held to a 1-1 draw. But away from home, they had a very impressive 3-1 victory. And if there's one player the Ivorians are going to keep a very close eye on, that's William Jebor. Now, William Jebor is 23 years of age. He plays in Spain. And he scored all four Liberian goals against Guinea-Bissau. So he clearly is going to be a marked man. And those matches take place between November 9 and 17. Just to stress, this is knockout football, home and away matches. The 20 overall winners, they will go through to a group stage that will begin next year. The 20 teams that fail, unfortunately, are out of the running for Russia.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Joining us now with more football news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Mali edged Ecuador 2-1 in a Group D tie at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Talca, Chile, on Wednesday. The victory strengthens Mali's chances of advancing to the knockout stage of the contest, having played to a scoreless draw against group leaders Belgium in their opening encounter. Today, Thursday, it's do or die for South Africa when they play North Korea in Group D action in Concepcion. South Africa lost their opening group tie to Costa Rica and need a win today to get their campaign back on track. In Switzerland, Nigeria's former FIFA Executive Committee member Amos Adamu is among several former and current FIFA executive members under investigation, the FIFA Independent Ethics Committee revealed in Zurich on Wednesday. This revelation comes barely 24 hours after FIFA Executive Committee granted the FIFA Independent Ethics Committee leeway to disclose to the public at their discretion what they are doing. Besides Adamu, Germany's Franz Beckenbauer, Spain's FIFA Vice President Angel Marie Villar, Thailand's Warawi Makudi, Cayman Islands' Jeffrey Webb, Brazil's Ricardo Teixeira, Uruguay's Eugenio Figueiredo, and Paraguay's Nicolas Loez are under investigation. The FIFA Ethics Committee also confirmed that FIFA President Sepp Blatter, FIFA Vice President Michel Platini, and FIFA Secretary General Jerome Vaux, who are serving a 90-day suspension, are also under investigation. In Tunis, defending champions Libya face Morocco in an African Nations Championship CHAN qualifier in the Tunisian capital Tunis today, Thursday. Having lost by a solitary goal to Tunisia last week, Libya need to triumph against Morocco to stand a chance of winning the three-way North Africa qualifier and proceed to defend their CHAN title at the contest in Rwanda scheduled for early next year. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. I recently changed my Facebook cover photo to some sportylicious artwork done by my VOA colleague Chris Mosby, who works in our graphics department. Chris depicts some basketball players, a female football player kicking the ball, a sprinter, and a boxer who looks an awful lot like Floyd Mayweather landing a right to his opponent's jaw. Check out the artwork if you get a chance. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOASunny. Floyd Mayweather recently announced his retirement from boxing after he beat Andre Berto by unanimous decision in Las Vegas, Nevada. Nicknamed the Money Man, Mayweather loves to flaunt his wealth on social media, showing fans his high-priced cars, watches, and private jet flights to exotic locations. On Wednesday, Mayweather posted a photo that symbolized a lot of his boxing success. He displayed more than 20 of his championship belts that he won during his 19-year career in the fight game. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, an African immigrant helps others who find themselves on the economic fringes in the land of opportunity. And a new report by the International Labor Organization finds a slight drop in the global youth unemployment rate. First, here's Carafala Kante of Guinea with Bagdegna Boga.
Yeah. kibaba koroya ay hamala demba ya lilabi luti kibaba koroya mfa ay hamala demba ya lilabi koni saya hamintala na tadu ya lumi adenu ya gilele koni saya hamintala na tadu ya lumi adenu ya gilele dunia mi alige mata tunya loro Kabadi ya bunya sine, imaye kono ya yikela iri bolonedi, giri temo giri diaro, subo ya yikela wula baledi, wula temo giri diaro, moni fi ya yikela wulo denedi, denge mo giri di. Niyani alige mata tunya loro anya silam bade yani na dunya itimi isoran sumama inani fale imabubula itimi la moya tumama ihakilile imademena ye itimi Madila kwikananyina ikananyini labango koni jomi labango bade nyali momade mena Koba sabali diyoro uliye bade nyado salale Koba sabali diyoro uliye bade nyado tumale Musoko Nima nyuma sodo ye bade nyado salale Nafoloko Nima ke hakili la ye bade nyado timale Duko kuma Maluma ke kunya Adala bankele ba woba ke Kedi wa yoro nyini Angu sumayi Angi silam bade nyala yo
Kira Fala Kante with Bagdegna Bogna. Well, every year, hundreds of thousands of people from around the world immigrate to the United States. 30-year-old Alpha Amadou Diallo came to New York from Guinea as a teenager. Diallo now helps others who find themselves on the economic fringes in the land of opportunity. VOA's Adam Phillips reports from New York.
Alpha Amadou Diallo sits at his dining room table, peering intently at a laptop screen. It's crowded with documents that may help him and his backers to open the Pan-African Federal Credit Union, a community-owned and operated bank in a low-income neighborhood in the Bronx, a borough of New York City. Although he's been in the United States for more than 15 years, he still remembers the joys he knew back home in Guinea.
Family, friends, mangoes, peace, memory, longing.
Diallo first visited America as a young boy during a family trip. He was intrigued by TV and movie images that portrayed America as a golden land of opportunity. He and some cousins were offered the chance to move to the Bronx, where many other Africans had already settled. They immediately said yes, but...
When we moved to the Bronx, it wasn't the Hollywood picture that I was used to. I lived with relatives, and it was a struggle, right? We didn't have a lot of means.
Diallo attended an all-immigrant high school. African immigrants were often teased and bullied by other students from nearby high schools. Once, he was physically attacked. Diallo says it was a shock to be seen by his peers as African at all. Back in Guinea, where everyone was African, he had simply been known as Alpha.
There are a lot of stereotypes, you know, poor Africans and living in trees, you know, playing with monkeys. I mean, there's a lot of misinformation, and it is painful. I think that is the psychological violence that says, right, you don't belong. And if you internalize that, you know, it's a very destructive.
Diallo took refuge in his studies and got excellent grades. a leadership teacher, Tom Porton, began to mentor him, taking him to museums, Broadway shows, and other New York offerings.
And he also introduced me to community service as well. So we did HIV AIDS, peer education, we did feeding the homeless, leadership groups. This was my first community organizing. It also made me relate that my story isn't just my individual story, right? My struggle is a larger struggle.
Diallo's search for himself continued at Bard College at Simon's Rock, the small New England liberal arts institution that admitted him during his junior year. Now, instead of seeing himself as Alpha, as he had back home, or even African, as he had been seen in high school, he says he now experienced a new identity, Black, underprivileged, and underrepresented. He and several of his peers also found that the writers they were assigned to read were all white Americans or Europeans. They yearned for a more global perspective.
And also, we felt that there was lack of racial diversity in the student body, in the faculty and staff. So we started organizing, and I helped found an organization called the Race Task Force. The fear is always being excluded and being alienated, but I think for me, organizing also gave me a community that really set me off to where I am today.
That and the writings of W.E.B. Du Bois, the early 20th century African-American activist who advocated education, self-reliance, and Pan-African pride as the keys to dignity and prosperity. That's when Diallo had the idea of a Pan-African Federal Credit Union as a way to help his community thrive.
A credit union is a community-owned financial institution. It is a people-owned entity. It has the potential to uplift the community.
After graduating college in 2005, Diallo went to graduate school, where he took courses in finance, banking, social entrepreneurship, and sustainable development. He felt those classes would give him the knowledge and skills he'd need to start a cooperative bank that would benefit folks both in the Bronx and in Africa. Diallo says the poor pay far more for financial services than the well-off. Take the fees African immigrants pay to send money back home. For the $60 billion in remittances they send to family members and loved ones, Africans in America pay about $16 billion in fees to corporations, banks, and money stores.
And this $16 billion is not coming back to the community, right? This is like lost. So the credit union needs to provide this channel where we can actually send money home at a very nominal cost. But even then, the profit comes back to the community.
Creating a federal credit union is a daunting and detailed task, but Diallo takes it step by step. He still needs to finish the fundraising, but the paperwork is in place, and he says the will and the need are there. All that's needed now is to finish the fundraising and finally celebrate. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
A new report by the International Labor Organization finds a slight drop in the global youth unemployment rate. Despite a few welcome signs of improvement, the ILO warns the youth jobless crisis remains acute and is far from over. Lisa Schleim reports from Geneva on the launch of the Global Employment Trends for Youth report.
The report finds a mild recovery in the job market for young people ages 15 to 24. It says the global unemployment rate stabilized at 13% in the 2012-2014 period covered. However, it adds, this is still well below the pre-crisis level of 11.7%. In total numbers, the report notes 73.3 million young people were out of work last year, down from the crisis peak of 76.6 million in 2009. Despite improvements, the report says the recovery is uneven across regions and countries. The report notes a slight decrease in youth unemployment in developed economies, including in the European Union, Latin America, and the Caribbean and sub-Saharan Africa. The jobless rate, however, increased in most of Asia and the Pacific, the Middle East, and North Africa. The ILO draws a sharp contrast between the situation in the United States and EU. It notes U.S. youth unemployment dropped from 18% in 2010 to 10% last year, whereas in some EU countries, more than 50% of young people were without work. Azita Berar Awad heads the ILO Employment Division. Awad says youth unemployment levels are highest in the Middle East and North Africa. She tells VOA the situation was related to violence and instability generated by the so-called Arab Spring.
Lack of decent jobs was at the root of Arabs. A spring in many countries, a very important factor. That doesn't mean the only factor. There was the way for democratization, but it was definitely the social conditions of young people. That the situation varies from country to country, but in general, obviously, the conflict doesn't help. It's not the optimal conditions and creates waves of migration.
Awad says it is premature to know how the mass exodus of migrants and refugees from the Middle East into Europe will affect the youth job market there. She says it is unlikely that this will have much impact, as young people in Europe and migrants do not compete for jobs in the same labor market. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On October 12, approximately 90 U.S. military personnel began deploying to Cameroon as part of continued U.S. support for the efforts of Cameroon and the other countries of the Lake Chad Basin to counter Boko Haram. This deployment, which has the consent and support of the government of Cameroon, bolsters U.S. support for airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance operations to support our African partners as they counter Boko Haram. The total number of U.S. military personnel to be deployed to Cameroon is anticipated to be up to approximately 300. The deployed personnel will support intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, or ISR, flights being conducted in the area. The results of these ISR flights will better enable African partners to secure their borders against Boko Haram. Information collected by these unarmed, remotely piloted aircraft will support regional operations against this and other terrorist threats. These deployed U.S. personnel, as White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said, will be part of a broader regional effort to stop the spread of Boko Haram and other violent extremist organizations in West Africa. When the president traveled to Africa earlier this year, he talked about how important it was for Africa, the nations of Africa, to pursue a regional approach to the threat that is posed by Boko Haram, Mr. Earnest said. And what the United States has done is try to offer some of the unique capabilities that we have in the United States military to assist that regional effort.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Her lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.